Well, you might not think of it as a prison break movie, but Schindler's List is the true life chronicle of a German Nazi, Oskar Schindler, who used his connections to the Nazi regime during World War II to save the lives of hundreds of Jewish prisoners. Now, you know your history that when Hitler set his unstable mind to expelling the world of Jews, the way he did it was he had them arrested and sent to concentration camps where the prisoners, men, women, and children, did hard labor until they were executed en masse in gas chambers. Of course, there were people that found this reprehensible, and Oskar Schindler was one of them, even though he himself was part of the Nazi party at the time. But he couldn't just come out and say so, could he? To disagree with Herr Hitler would be to find yourself in a concentration camp or dead. So what he did was he used his business acumen to deceive the Nazis and to subvert their plans to annihilate the Jews. And what he did was he bought a factory that formerly produced pots and pans, and he turned it into a munitions factory that would make casings for bullets and shells for bombs. And then he convinced the Nazis, he bribed them, the officials, to let him select a list of Jews from the concentration camp that would leave the camps and work for him for no pay, as slaves. And unbeknownst to the Nazi authorities, Schindler had specifically ordered the Jewish foreman of his factory and his new force of slaves that were working for him that he would be highly disappointed if the factory ever produced a working bombshell. So he actually wasn't doing this for the Nazis at all. It was simply to save these Jews from death. Well, to subvert their cause and save them is his mission, is what made him so famous among the Jewish community. And in fact, today he has a tree planted at the museum Yad Vashem, which is a museum that remembers the Holocaust in Jerusalem. And the tree is planted in the Avenue of the Righteous Gentiles with a little plaque commemorating what he did for the Jews. So the question is, was he a righteous Gentile in what he did? I mean, did he do the right thing? Think about it. He bribed government officials. He lied to them about the purpose of what he was doing. He told officials he wanted the Jews as slaves to help the Nazi war effort, when actually he was using them to do the exact opposite of what the Nazis would have wanted. He also set up a pretend ammunition factory to look like he was telling the truth, but to actually cover up his deception of what he was really doing. Of course, if he did tell the truth, hey, I want to save as many Jews from the concentration camps as I can afford, and then not make ammunition for you, they would not only have refused to help him to do that, they would probably have killed him. So, did he do the right thing or not? Well, that's a good question. Why don't you turn your Bibles to Exodus chapter 1, and we'll look at another scenario that will get us thinking. Now, just a recap of where we are. Last week, we looked at how the Jews, the Hebrews, at this point they're called Hebrews, they'll later be called Israelites, how the Hebrews got into Egypt to begin with. So that for the rest of the time, we can talk about how they get out of Egypt in the Exodus, right? And we saw that it was God's plan all along, that when God made the covenant with Abraham in Genesis 15, that he would have a mighty nation. Part of the prediction was that mighty nation would end up as slaves for 400 years, and that God would then take them out of slavery. And so this was God's plan all along, because it was a picture of God's redemption that he would point back to throughout the rest of scriptures. And in fact, what Jesus did on the cross for us spiritually would be compared to what God did for the Hebrews physically by rescuing them without their own power. So we saw how that happened. And basically, the bottom line is that one of Israel's sons, remember Jacob was renamed Israel, one of Israel's sons, Joseph, was ended up in Egypt as a slave, and then rose through God's providence to prominence in the kingdom, the right-hand man of the Pharaoh. And then because of the famine in the world, all of his brothers came and he reconciled and had his father come out, and they all moved there. And the Pharaoh, because he was so indebted to Joseph, gave them the best land, the land of Goshen. And they stayed there and they multiplied and they became a powerful, wealthy, influential class of people in Egypt. And they never bothered to go back for many, many generations. So that's where we find the story. We are now in verse 8, to the end of the chapter. Exodus 1, verse 8. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from our land. So, therefore, set taskmasters over them to afflict them with the heavy burdens. And they built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad. And the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they ruthlessly made the people of Israel work as slaves and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and all kinds of work in the field. In all their work, they ruthlessly made them work as slaves." Now, just stop there for now. If I had to ask you, is slavery okay biblically? I mean, is God okay with slavery? Your initial reaction might be, well, no way. God would have nothing to do with slavery. And you'd be right, especially if you're thinking of the type of slavery you probably are thinking of. Slavery is wicked and abusive, and it's unjust, and God wants no part in it. But you would probably be talking about a particular type of slavery, the one that we're familiar with from modern history, and from movies about slaves and that. But some slavery in history and in the Bible is not in itself inherently evil. It should be thought of more of as a contractual employment. Some slaves in the Bible were even willingly slaves. They came into contractual employment because they had no other means of providing for themselves. They were provided for by their masters. They got board and lodging. They got their food thrown in. And some of them even earned a stipend, a payment. And if they wanted to, they could save that up and they could buy their freedom back later on. Other slaves were sentenced to slavery, usually because of debt. Imagine that happened today. We wouldn't have the credit card crisis we have, right? You got into debt, you didn't pay your credit card, so you then work for the company for free until you can pay back that debt. And again, the purpose was to pay it back so you could get your freedom again. Generally speaking, the slaves were treated humanely. It was, our equivalent would be prisons. I mean, prisoners work in the prisons for next to nothing. They get a tiny stipend, but they have board and lodging, kind of. I mean, it's not very comfortable probably, but they're taken care of and they have their needs provided and they're there because of what they've done. And some slaves were there because of that. There were other types of slaves that were prisoners of war. You know, when in those days when a country wanted to expand, you know, they needed some Lebensraum. They would just kind of show up and take over a land. And then they would give all the occupants the choice. Do you want to stay and work as slaves for us or do you want to die? And that can be your choice. And so some people would choose death and some people would choose slavery. And it was considered a very merciful thing to not just wipe out everybody, to give them the option to stay in your house and keep your little life going, but you now work for us as slaves. So there was that type of slavery. And as you can see, they're kind of becoming more and more sinister types. And then there is the other extreme, which is also found in the Bible, but it's the one most of you are thinking of. We know from modern history of American and Europeans going to Africa and South America primarily and other places as well, and kidnapping those people and forcing them into hard labor for no payment and they had no rights. And the Bible has a specific word for that type of enslaving, and it is called kidnapping. And that is, of course, completely repugnant to God and sinful. 1 Timothy 1, verse 10 says, in a list of people who don't go to heaven, are those who are the sexually immoral, men who practice homosexuality, enslavers, and the NASB has there, the New American Standard Bible translates that, kidnappers, liars, perjurers, and whatever else is contrary to sound doctrine. So the New Testament recognizes that forcing somebody into slavery, kidnapping, taking them away from their homeland, and making them do work for you is actually sin. It's contrary to sound doctrine, right up there with lying. Just bear that in mind for later in our text. Now, in our text, Pharaoh decides that the best way to deal with the Hebrew immigrant population is to force them into labor. Manual labor. Why waste them by chasing them out of the land when you can use them? So they just make a new law. Okay, if you're a Hebrew, you now work for us, and we're going to go build the store city of Ramses, and you're going to do it for free. You can resist, and we'll kill you. You can flee, and we'll kill you. Or you can work. I mean, what would you choose? I mean, the Jews didn't really have much option, did they? They couldn't exactly leave. Where would they go? You see, the land that had been promised to their forefathers had now been occupied by Canaanites and Perizzites and Kenites and various other littleites that took over and had been living there for 400 years. They can't just show up and say, hey, we want our land back. And even if they did, how would they get there without the Egyptians hunting them down and killing them? So they didn't have a choice. They stayed as slaves. Now, bear in mind that this plan of the king was legal. It was perfectly legal, and it was allowed, permissible. But was it right? Was it right? See, I want you to put that question on a little post-it note on the fridge in your mind, and just we'll get back to that. But I want you to realize that there's sometimes things that are legal that aren't right in God's eyes. And yet God allowed this to happen. God allowed the government authorities to come up with this law change, and for a reason. This was predicted, remember? You see, the Jews were stuck in Egypt. They were in the best land in Egypt. They were wealthy, they were powerful, they were influential, and they had no reason to go back to the promised land. But God wanted them in the promised land. Part of his dealings with them. It was part of how he was going to show the world how he was going to bless this nation. He didn't want them integrating with the Egyptians and just disappearing as a people. He wanted them as an isolated unit that he could bless in a very particular way, in a very particular place, so that the rest of the world could see, when you're right with God, this is how God deals with you. And that's where the covenants come in later on. Now, how would you get somebody out of their comfortable, I mean, if you live in a nice comfortable house in a nice comfortable suburb, what would be the push factor to get you out? Speed bumps, maybe, you know, or something, but traffic, or there would need to be a serious push factor to get you to leave your comfort. You would usually want to go for something more comfortable, but now what would get these people out? So God needed a catalyst to force them out, and so this government rule is actually the catalyst, the push factor that God uses to make the Jews start crying out to want to leave Egypt because of the way they were being treated in Egypt. Now, because something is legal doesn't necessarily mean that it's right. What makes something right or wrong is what God says, not what the authority says. And yet God puts the authorities over us in order to guide us, doesn't he? Romans 13, verse 1, a passage we actually read today in the morning service. Romans 13, 1 says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And those that exist have been instituted by God. And verse 4 says, for he, the ruler, is God's servant for your good. We saw that this morning as well, that the authorities forced Simon of Cyrene into service to carry the cross, and that random selection was a purposeful election by God, and Simon Cyrene ends up saved, and his sons end up saved, and his wife ends up saved, and he ends up being an influence in the kingdom because of what the authorities did, even though it seemed unpleasant at the time. And so God says that even if your authorities are wicked and evil, you need to submit to them. And even if the decisions they make are things that you wouldn't want them to make, that is still God's will for your life, what the authorities do. It's one of the ways that God guides us through life, by giving us laws that we're not allowed to break. But the question arose this morning, and I told you to come this evening, we'll answer it. What happens when the government doesn't do what God intended? What happens when they enslave you and they abuse you? What happens when they instruct you to sin against God? And that brings us to our next point. So the first section we've been looking at here, you can kind of put under the heading, slavery sanctioned. Slavery sanctioned. And now we're going to look at infanticide instituted. That's kind of our two headings. I forgot to give them to you earlier today. Two legal evils, you might call them. Two legal evils and the responses as an example to us in our evil society. Because there are legal evils in our society. Did you know that? And so one of the legal evils we see in this passage is that slavery was sanctioned. It was allowed. It was legal. But that didn't make it right. Here's another one. Infanticide instituted. Infanticide is the killing of babies. Look at verse 15. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shifra and the other Pua. I bet you didn't know that until you read that verse, right? That's a great Bible trivia question for your kids. What are the Hebrew midwives' names? Shifra and Pua. Verse 16. When you serve as a midwife to the Hebrew woman and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live. This is a new rule. This is a law that's coming from the king. He's making it legal to kill Hebrew baby boys. And so he calls the midwives in, the ladies that would help with the birth, and he says, when the woman's on the birth stool, you know, I didn't do a lot of historical research into how they gave birth. I'm just assuming there was a stool involved. But anyway, when she's on this contraption, you know, and about to give birth, and you're going to go and help and catch the baby, then make sure that when you do, it is, if it's a boy, you got to kill it. And he institutes this rule of infanticide, and he instructs Shiphrah and Puah to kill them. Now, the idea is that the population would decrease by half within one generation, because every second person born is a male in general. Sometimes not in our church. We have a lot of one for a while, a lot of the others. But in the end, it kind of balances out. And so if you got rid of all the males, that's half the Hebrew population right then. And in successive generations, there would be even fewer of them because there would be too many women and not enough men for husbands. And eventually, they would kind of taper off. This is the idea. And so he comes up with this rule. And the reason he's doing it is because of politics. This is how he's dealing with the growing immigrant population problem of his country. We'll just kill the babies. We'll kill the baby boys. When society falls this low, there's not much further it can fall. I mean, it is one of the most basic of human instincts to protect babies, isn't it? I mean, you would go and you would watch a boxing match and two grown men beating each other's brains out. I don't know if you would or you wouldn't, but imagine it was a grown man beating the brains out of a baby. That's not sport. That's ridiculous. It goes against every fiber of every human being. Our job is to protect the innocent, to protect the helpless, and what could be more innocent and helpless than a little baby? And yet, this is the plan the man comes up with. This is as far as he's willing to go, is to not protect the babies, but actually to kill them. And human beings are designed this way for a reason, I believe. There's a lot of things that you can ignore and you can put out of your mind, but you can't put out of your mind a crying baby. Have you ever noticed that? Sometimes when it's quite quiet up here and Charles trying to say the pastoral prayer and in the back there's some babies and they're crying. Where does your mind go? To the prayer? No. To the baby. Please keep quiet, honey. And it's the reason you get up at night when the baby's crying. You can't, you know, you can tune out a lot. Thunderstorms and barking dogs, put a pillow over your head, but the baby's crying. You can't tune that out. It's not only the physical sound, there's a conscience issue involved. I can't let the thing cry. It's my baby. I've got to get up, honey. One of us has to get up. But it's hardwired in us to look after them. You're walking down the road and you hear in a dumpster crying coming from out of that. You won't be like, I'm kind of late for my appointment. That's someone else's problem. You would drop everything to go for that. And why? Because human beings need help. We're born that way. God has made us that way on purpose so that we learn dependence from the moment we're born. I mean, when a wildebeest is born, it comes out a little knock-kneed and, you know, sticky, but it can walk. You give it a few minutes, it can walk, it can fend for itself, it can feed itself, and it can run away if it needs to. Not the same for a human. A human being needs to be taken care of, needs to be fed, needs to be changed, needs to be clothed, needs to be sheltered for, I don't know how long. Like at least, like 7 years, I guess, or 18 is considered normal, and some households, maybe even this church, 32 or so. People need a little nudge out of the nest to learn how to do their own laundry. But it's unnatural to hurt a child. And yet this is where Pharaoh in his religion is allowed to go. Because in his religion, he is a deity. He is a god. And so he's playing God with human life. And this is in his legal right to do this because of politics. Let me ask you this. What in our culture is a perfect congruent application for this? Abortion. Not a big jump from this text to that the modern curse of abortion, is it? That the most basic tenet of a woman, the most basic instinct that she has for a child is to look after it, to nurture it, to feed it, to protect it, and our society is telling women that it's okay, it's not unethical, it's perfectly legal to kill your child if you don't want it. Some countries have more strict rules. Ours have very lax rules, depending on the age and the gestation period, how far the baby's gone. You can kill the baby without even telling your parents, getting permission, or giving a reason. As long as it's still in the womb before a certain time of development. Another example in our world today is China's draconian one-child policy. You combine a legal policy that you're only allowed to have one child in your family with a legal policy that says you're allowed to abort on demand, and what do you get? You get the exact thing that's happening here. They go for a scan. They see that it's a girl. In the Chinese system, the people who are not wealthy enough to provide for themselves in their retirement and that, the way that you're provided for is that your sons work for you, and they pay for you in your old age. And so if you don't have a son, you've got no one to look after you in your old age. And so if your one child is a daughter, you've got to kill the daughter. And in China, it's very, very common that not only are the daughters aborted, but that they are killed after they are born, because some of the people are too poor to even go for the scan to find out. So they just have the baby, see what it is. It's a girl, kill it. We'll try again. And so the girls are being killed in their millions in China and in South Africa and in America and all over Europe and in any country where it's legal to kill children before they're born. And so let me ask you this. Is baby killing right just because the government says it's legal? What should our response be besides revulsion? Well, let's learn from the midwives. What did they do? Look at verse 17. But the midwives feared God. You could just stop there and do another whole sermon on that. That's your response. You don't listen to what the government says is right. You fear God. You do what it takes to do what God says. The Hebrew midwives feared God, verse 17, and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the male children live. So the king of Egypt called the midwives and said to them, why have you done this? You know, I went to the nursery at the hospital. There's a lot of blue cribs there. What's going on? And didn't I give you an instruction? And she, why have you let the male children live? Verse 19, the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women, they're not like the Egyptian women, for they're vigorous and they give birth before the midwife comes to them. I mean, really? Yeah, we're just a different race of people. Yeah, just pop them out before we even get there. It's like, oh, honey, contractions. Oh, here's the baby. No need for a midwife. Really? So you're a professional midwife who's never delivered a baby before, right? Because they always just come out too quickly. I mean, they're lying. They're not telling the truth. That's not the reason. I mean, it tells us in the text why the children are alive. Because the Hebrew midwives ignored Pharaoh. That's what it says. They didn't do what Pharaoh said. And they lied to him about the reason. Why did they lie, do you think? They're trying to save their skin. Verse 20. Now look at this. So God dealt well with the midwives. Isn't that interesting? And the people multiplied and they grew very strong. Slavery didn't work, and this policy didn't work because the boys just, they kept coming. Verse 21, and because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. A great blessing from the Lord. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, the Egyptians, every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall cast into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live. He took the law out of the hands of the Hebrews because they weren't obeying him. And yet, their story was, well, you know, we couldn't get there in time. So he says, fine. And he shifts the policy and he says to the Egyptians, it's now legal to kill Hebrew boys. It doesn't matter if it's at the birth stool or not. You see a little baby boy, you throw it in the Nile. I mean, it's just, it's shocking. It's shocking. The next time in history this happens is when Herod says the same. He wants to kill all the baby boys under the age of 2 to make sure that he wipes out Jesus. And the next time that happens in history is when abortion becomes legal and normalized in our society. I think 100 years from now, maybe longer, it'll take, people will look back in history and say the three darkest eras in history were what Pharaoh did here, what Herod did, and what our governments have allowed us to do. Now, this is a very tricky question, though, isn't it? It's one of two tricky passages in the Bible about lying. The other one is, of course, Rahab in the book of Joshua, where she saves the Hebrew spies by lying about them being there. So some people go to these passages and come up with the concept of the white lie. Have you ever heard of the white lie as opposed to the black lie? You know, the black lie is the one God doesn't like. The white lie is one that's totally okay. It's like when your wife says, does the stress make me look fat? Well, you tell the white lie. I mean, she does. But you're not going to say that. That would be unloving. What would Jesus do? He would totally lie, right? Right? Because you've got to remember that whatever you say is not sin means Jesus could have done it. Because Jesus never sinned. So when your boss asks you, have you got that report done? Of course it's done. I'll just go get it quickly and put it on your desk. You know, just so that you avoid the embarrassment and the difficulty in your job. It's just a white lie because you're going to quickly do it before you bring it there. I mean, it's done in your mind. Would Jesus do that? Some would say yes. Yeah, in seminary we had a study. We took a whole class on ethics. And one of the textbooks we had to read to be able to refute it, by the way, was Joseph Fletcher's Situational Ethics. Situational ethics is the idea that God gives us rules, laws, and lying is one of them. You're not allowed to lie. But that each situation is quite unique and that God wants us to use our discernment and figure out in the moment what the greater good is. And so it's okay to commit, you've heard of the term of the lesser of two evils. So there's only two evils, so you pick the lesser one. And Fletcher would go to this passage and say, it's an evil to kill babies, and it's an evil to lie, but the lesser of the two evils is which one? The lying. And he would say, you see, everyone knows that. Everyone knows you don't kill the baby, you choose to lie. And the scenario people always come up with is, you know, the Nazis knock on your door during World War II and say, are you hiding any Jews in here? And let's say you are. What do you say? Well, you lie to save them, right? As if the Nazis are going to be like, oh, okay, thanks, we'll go to the next house. It's kind of a scenario. But people are like, sometimes lying is good because it saves lives. Or more commonly, you would say it spares people's feelings. It is a way of being polite and loving. And honestly, if you do try to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth all the time, it does lead to some socially awkward moments, doesn't it? Oh, I just got my hair cut. What do you think? I think it makes your face look fatter. What you asked, right? Is that not the right answer? So, you know, in our house, the way we deal with that is just don't ask daddy a question that you don't want the answer to, you know? Because we try to encourage truthfulness. But now, what about the situational ethics? What's the opposite of that? Well, the opposite of that is something called absolute ethics. An example would be the Feinberg brothers wrote a book. Paul and John Feinberg wrote a book called Ethics for a Brave New World, where they go into things like contraception and euthanasia and all sorts of things that have come in the modern world. And they explain their view of absolute ethics, which means that if something's wrong, it's always wrong and you're never allowed to do it. So which of these do we like? Well, it doesn't matter, actually. That's a stupid question. It doesn't matter which one we like. Which one do we agree with because of what the Bible says? Let me ask you this question of this text. I want you to think carefully because it sounds like Joseph Fletcher is making a good example. Obviously, you'd rather lie than kill the babies. But is that what's going on in this text? If you look carefully, what did the Hebrew midwives do? They saved the babies' lives by disobeying the government. And we're going to look in a minute if that's a sin. But at that point, the children's lives are saved. When Pharaoh calls them to account and they lie, they're not lying to save the baby's life. The baby's lives are already saved. Why are they lying? To save their own lives. So that just puts a little light in it. They're actually not choosing between killing babies and lying to Pharaoh. They're choosing between lying to Pharaoh about what they did and therefore escaping the consequence of breaking the law. So that bear that in mind. Same with Rahab. Rahab hid the Hebrew spies, but she didn't have to say well, yeah, no, I saw them, they ran down that way. She could have taken the consequence of, I'm not going to tell you what I've seen. You can kill me. But she lied to save her own skin again, right? Now, people would say, yes, but God rewarded Rahab. She's in the Messianic line. She's the one person that survives the fall of Jericho because of the scarlet thread out of her window. Remember that? Why? Because she saved the spies. Fletcher would say, in this passage, God's rewarding the midwives. Obviously, God's okay with what they did. True. But which part of what they did is God okay with? Saving the babies. You always side with God. You always side with God's people. And that's what Rahab was doing. She sided with God and with God's people, and she was rewarded for that. Now, how the Hebrew midwives went about saving their own skin after they had done that, we don't have to agree with that to realize that God was rewarding them for what they did. Obviously, what they did was the right thing, and God's rewarding them for that. The way they did it was tainted with their human weakness and their sin. We don't have to say, well, the end justifies the means. It was the lesser of two evils. You don't have to come up with a whole system. God's rewarding them for one part of what they did, and he's having mercy and grace because of the other part. Let me tell you something. That's how you worship. Every time you ever do anything right, you're also doing something wrong, if you think about it. It's very difficult to do anything worshipful for the Lord that isn't tainted at all, one little bit, by your sin. I mean, have you ever done something selfless and sacrificial and helped somebody in some way and then felt good about it? Why do you feel good about it? That was just your duty. Well, I'm kind of good because I did that, right? Or people thank you for it or encourage you and say, wow, you're really gifted at that. And your pride gets puffed up. Does that mean you should never, ever do that again? Ever? No, of course not. You just work on the pride issue. In the meantime, God's giving you opportunities, and he's faithful with little and faithful with much, and he blesses you and he rewards you, and he covers up the way you do it with his grace. Because if he didn't, we'd all go to hell. Because we could never be perfect. So we're not going to judge the Hebrew midwives. I mean, seriously, if I were a Jew hiding in your house and the Nazis knocked on your door and said, are you hiding an archer, the Jew, in your house, I would want you to lie. I mean, I'm not going to tell them I'm here. Don't tell them anything. I don't care what you tell them. Save me, you know? So I don't know. I don't want to judge them. But at the same time, we can't go to passages like this and come up with a system that now allows us to sin sometimes. You see, let me ask you this. Why did Peter deny Jesus? Save his own skin. Yeah. He was asked. Hey, you're a Galilean. You were with that other Galilean, the one that's about to be crucified. And Peter said, I don't know the man. Why did he say that? He's saving his own life. And yet, can you read that passage and say, oh, that's a perfect example of situational ethics. He was doing exactly the right thing. No, he wept bitterly. Jesus predicted that as an example of his weakness and his cowardliness and his betrayal of Jesus. All he was doing was saving his own skin by telling a lie. It was sin then, and it's sin for the Hebrew wives, and it was sin for Rahab, and it's sin when you do it. You can't lie. You've got to bear in mind when you read these passages, these are descriptive passages. It's a narrative part of the Bible. A descriptive passage just tells you what the people did. You can't go and take a lesson from that and say, therefore I must do that, or I'm allowed to do that. Samson, you know. Slept around before he was married, tied foxes together, that can't be good, set them alight, killed people, committed suicide. I mean, he did a whole lot of things. Disobeyed his parents, disobeyed God, cut his hair. In his case, that was wrong. You can't look at that and say, oh, I must do the same thing. Let me read for you some prescriptive passages where God does talk about what he thinks about lying. Proverbs 6, verse 16. There are six things that the Lord hates, yea, seven that are an abomination to him. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, and hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that make haste to run to evil, and a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows discord among brothers. Interesting. On the list of the seven things God hates, lying is on the same list as the shedding of innocent blood, what the Pharaoh did. What the Hebrew midwives did, part of what they did, is on the same list of what the Pharaoh was doing. only lines on there twice. Did you notice that? Ephesians 4:25. Therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. The New Testament says, don't lie to each other, ever. So, let me be clear. It's never okay to tell a lie. Ever. 1 Corinthians 10:13 is the verse that I would go to support my view of absolute ethics. Absolute ethics means that when God gives a rule, you can never break that rule. It's never okay. It's never the lesser of two evils. You're never supposed to do evil. Jesus never, ever did evil because, oh, well, he had to pick between these two evils. And in 1 Corinthians 10:13, we're told that there's no temptation that has overtaken you except that which is common to man. It specifically says that God will give you a way of escape, right? So there's never a situation that you will ever be in that the only solution is to sin against God. Because he will always give you the way of escape. There is always a way to not sin. Now, what that looks like takes great discernment. And remember, if there's weakness, God forgives you for that. But you can't live your life as if sometimes it's okay to sin. It's never, ever, ever okay to sin. You know, if you were the Hebrew midwife and you were sinless, what would Jesus do? And the Pharaoh says, why are these little boys running around my town? Well, we disobeyed you. Lock us up. Kill us. Well, you think I'm going to kill a baby? I'd rather die than do that, wouldn't you? Would you kill a baby so that you stayed out of jail? Of course not. There's nothing wrong with admitting that. The government comes in here and says, you know, Ken Archer, the pastor of this church, you're not allowed to preach on these certain issues anymore. What am I supposed to do? I'm going to preach on them. And then when they come and say, did you preach on them? I'm going to say, yeah, here's the audio. You should listen to it carefully. I'm not going to say, no, I didn't preach on it. That's a big conspiracy. Someone put that on the internet so that I can live to preach another day. No, you do what it takes and you deal with the consequences. And we see this pretty clearly in Acts chapter 5 when the apostles were told not to preach by the authorities and they were locked up. And then there's the angel jailbreak. That's a cool jailbreak movie right there. And the angel lets them escape. And then Peter's busy preaching. And then the authorities show up and say in public, we strictly charged you not to teach in this name. You're not allowed to preach Jesus. Yet you filled Jerusalem with your teaching. You've disobeyed us. And you intend to bring this man's blood on us. But Peter and the apostles answered, we must obey God rather than men. And people will say, aha, there you go. He sinned because he disobeyed the government. Lesser of two evils. But this is something you've got to understand carefully. Disobeying the government is not sin. Well, didn't you just read Romans 13? Listen, the government has authority over you, and you always need to obey it, but when they command you to sin, it's not sin to resist that command. It's the right thing. The government doesn't have the authority to command you to sin. Just like parents don't have the authority to command their children to sin. It's one of the worst things you can do is like, okay, now when we go to Granny's house, just tell her that you love the socks she gave you. I know you threw them to the dog because you hated them, but don't tell her that. If she says, where are they? Say, I forgot to pack them. Because that'll just make Granny happy. You're training your child to lie. No, if you don't do that. But the government, you can't instruct your child to lie. You don't have the authority. If they go to Granny and Granny says, what happened to the socks? And say, I didn't like them. I fed them to my dog. You can't punish the child for not obeying you. Oh, you get a spank, disobedient to parents, because you told the truth there. I told you not to. Now, I've tried to explain to my kids, other people still believe in the tooth mouse and Santa Claus, so, you know, just smile and nod. But if someone asks you flat out, and somebody has, tell them the truth. You know, you're just the bearer of the news. You didn't make it up. So, they're not sinning by disobeying the government. They would be sinning by lying about it. Oh, what? Oh, you told us not to. Oh, we didn't understand. That's lying. They just said, you judge. We're willing to go to jail, and they did for what they did. Good. Now, let me just explain again. Praise be to God that our salvation doesn't depend on us doing everything perfectly, right? We would all be condemned, except for God's grace. But don't use your grace, God's grace, as a cloak to sin deliberately. Romans 6:1 says, what shall we say? Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? By no means. Okay, so just to make sure that you understand the application, this doesn't mean that when you read of Jacob Zuma's personal life being wicked or his politics being stupid or his government being incompetent or corrupt, that you can now drive any speed you want in the freeway. Well, the Hebrew midwives disobeyed the government because that government was wicked. No, that's not an application. You can't stop paying your taxes. You can't ignore municipal zoning requirements when you build. No, you need to obey the law. Unless the law tells you specifically to sin, at that point, you have to disobey the law and you have to take the consequences and be willing to take the consequences. Now, if you live in a country where it allows legal protest like we do, you can toy to your heart's content because we're allowed to. That's not even disrespectful. This does not also this does not mean that you can tell white lies to squirm out of difficult situations. Always tell the truth. Don't ask your spouse a question you don't want them to answer truthfully. Now, Oscar Schindler performed a noble and courageous act. He sacrificed his wealth, his own safety, for the life of strangers. Was this a righteous act? Absolutely. Did he have to lie and deceive to do it effectively? Yeah, I think he did. I mean, it wouldn't have worked if he was a really truthful, honest guy. Wouldn't have been able to do it. Does that mean it's okay to lie? I don't know. We don't have a lot of Nazis around these days. But we had a guy in our ethics class who told the professor was teaching us absolute ethics, and the guy told us, listen, if the Nazis ever come to town, you can come hide at my house, because I got no problem lying to Nazis. So, my job is to tell you what God wants. He wants mercy and compassion and sacrifice and love and honesty. How that all works together in war and murder, I leave that up to your conscience and God's wisdom. I'm glad we're not the ones that have to judge men. But if you take the Hebrew midwives as the reason you lie to your wife to keep the peace, or you lie to your boss to keep from looking bad, or you lie to the traffic cop to keep from getting a ticket, then you've missed the point of the passage, haven't you? The rule of thumb is glorify God in all that you do, love mercy, do justly, walk humbly with your God. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we are thankful for your word, and sometimes it really does challenge us to think through it carefully, but we're so grateful to know that we are never in a position where we have to sin against you, that you always give us the way of escape. I pray, Lord, that this very week when temptation comes, you would show us the way of escape and give us the fortitude to stand up for you and what you have given us in your word to believe. Now, Lord, as we go to the table, we thank you for the picture of Jesus Christ dying for us on the cross. And as we can celebrate the gospel one more time today, we bless your name, and we thank you for this in Jesus' name.